I'm very happy to see all of you. I know that I've traveled farther than you have, but you may have had a more arduous day than I. So I'm very glad to be here with you. Our topic tonight is a very important one. It's not only specifically the path of Kriya Yoga as given to us by the masters, whose pictures are behind me, who the method so thrillingly described in Autobiography of a Yogi that makes almost everyone want to rush out and figure out how you can find the Kriya. But in addition to the specifics of this particular path, which I will give you some sharing about what that is, when I was reflecting on it, I realized that what has to come first before we absorb any particular path is that we have to reach the point in our lives where we're ready to really make a change. Even Kriya, as Master describes it, as I call him, as Yoganandaji describes it in Autobiography of a Yogi, it doesn't have any effect on us unless we practice it. I remember many years ago, as Shurjo mentioned, I met Swami Kriyananda when I was just in my early 20s. And over the course of many years, I was a companion on an extremely interesting journey that really has brought us right to this point. Swami Kriyananda is an American, was an American, disciple of an Indian master, a real citizen of the globe. And he started his work in California, but eventually it spread here, and we now have communities and centers and teaching in this country where Master came from. And in the course of that, we did a lot in America and in Europe and so on. And I remember one particular cycle when Swami Kriyananda was trying to establish a center in the city of San Francisco. And he was giving lots of lectures in the evening. At that time, he was he wasn't the only teacher, but he was the primary teacher. Many of us were still being trained. This was like the late 1970s. And in addition to lecturing all during the day, and the subject he was teaching was called Superconscious Living. And this was a program that he had developed, which was a way to introduce people to the path of Kriya, which I'll talk about in a little bit more. But just like trying to get people to understand that this isn't just a matter of an hour in the morning and an hour at night. It's a whole attitude toward life. It's the way we approach it. It's how we relate to God. It's how we magnetize energy out of ourselves, how we work, how we take care of our children. And night after night, all through the area of San Francisco and in cities nearby, he was giving these lectures. And never one to be doing just one thing at a time. Simultaneously, he was recording an album of chanting. He had a beautiful singing voice, and he wrote many songs, and he sang the songs that Yogananda wrote. And there were not many people around who had much real technical ability, so I ended up being his recording engineer, which, if you know me at all, which perhaps we'll get better acquainted, that was a really awful choice, and it only tells you that he had no other choice but me. And this was the time when recordings were made on reel-to-reel tape, and we had this big tape recorder. And after he finished his programs, which would be 10 or so at night at least, he would go back to this apartment he had in San Francisco, and I would go with him, and we would set up the tape recorder and the microphone, just one microphone, and he sat with his harmonium, and he would chant for a half an hour or an hour, and we would put the music onto the tapes. Well, one particular night, he wanted to record, and I simply could not get the sound to stick to the tape. Everything seemed to be working as it had always worked, but we would every time I tested it, I would play it back and the tape would be blank. And I said, "Sir, I can't seem to make it work." He said, "Well, I'll go meditate for a while." So he went and meditated, and he came back after 15 minutes and I was still just agitated, and I'm reading the manual like this and testing all the pieces, and I'm on the phone calling everybody I can think of to call. "No, sir, I don't have it yet." He went back and meditated, and finally this thought occurred to me, And I said, Divine Mother, if you want this recording to happen, clearly you're going to have to intervene because I'm not going to be able to make it happen myself. Then I took every plug and I took them all apart, every single thing I could take apart. I put it back together in exactly the same way, and lo and behold, the music was on the tape. Yes, sir. And then he did a beautiful hour-long session. So the next night, he's speaking to a very large hall, very large number of people, and without giving me any warning, he says, Asha has something she wants to share. So I'm accustomed to cooperating with him, so I walked on stage and I was all the way at the mic, and I said, what is it that I have to share? And he said, well, just tell them about the recording last night. And I remembered and I understood because I had told him, because he asked me, how did you fix it? I said, I didn't. I just prayed to Divine Mother and suddenly it worked. So I told that story just as I've told it to you here. But the message of the story, I feel, Swamiji put into my mind to say, it doesn't matter how fabulous the teaching, doesn't matter how great the guru is, nothing will happen unless you remember to use the teaching. And that was exactly the position that I was in. The habit of the mind is to think, I can solve this problem. I can find the answer in the manual. I can make enough phone calls and somebody will rescue me. And then somewhere along the line, it occurs to us that the real power and force of our life is coming from a higher level. And there's a difference between having a general idea that that's true and actually aligning our thoughts and our feelings and our consciousness and really trusting with more than average force that that is the reality. I recently read a very interesting article in a magazine. A man wrote a book, and it's mostly about business. Maybe you all have read the book. It's called David and Goliath. I haven't read the book. I just read the author's comments, which I'm going to share. And it's a book about how unlikely people succeed. And I don't think there was anything spiritual in the intention of the book, but this is the final chapter. This is how the author explained it. He had heard about a couple somewhere in America who follow a kind of very focused kind of Christianity, but a particular branch of it. And their daughter had been murdered, and brutally murdered. And he had heard that even at the time when it was discovered that she was murdered, their first response was compassion for the man who did it. That how could anyone be so filled with hate that they would carry out something like this? So the author was curious, I mean, on a deep level curious, to understand how a human being could rise to such a high level when everything in you would pull you down. And so the end of his book is an interview with those people. And the article I read was how it changed him. And he was talking about, because he'd been studying business and the power of money and the power of education and position in the world, but talking to that simple couple and their ability to transcend what would be every parent's worst nightmare and not merely be able to deal nobly with their own disappointment, but to actually have their consciousness go out even beyond their own suffering. And he was explaining how we really have forgotten where power really comes from. That we imagine the power of this world is the world that we see. And we have forgotten that there is a power that is so much greater. And he realized at the end of his research for this book that every individual that he was highlighting in the book, some way or another, had moved from their outer circumstances into their inner power. And that's what had enabled them, whatever their field, to triumph over obstacles and to achieve whatever goal they were setting for themselves. Whether in the case of that couple, it was compassion and forgiveness, or an entrepreneur trying to create a new company and a new service for the world. When we start talking about the path of Kriya Yoga, we are talking about a specific way to meditate. We are talking about a specific line of masters. We are talking about a spiritual family that is well established in many parts of the world and has wide open doors and hearts for all, as we often think of it, our yet unmet brothers and sisters. So it has all of those external realities, which we will explain to you how you can access them if any of them attract you. But what it really is, it's a doorway into our own untapped resources. We live in this world with such a sense of being controlled by the world. I'm sure all of you feel that. When I was a young woman, before I met Swami Kriyananda and found my way onto this spiritual path, I was very capable in a certain way. I've always been articulate. I have a quick mind. I could move through life in a way that seemed effective. I don't, without going into it in great detail, it was a very odd period, because in the eyes of the world, and the only way things were measured, I seemed very competent. But inside my own heart, I was always aware of the fact that I was free-floating. I was adrift. That there was no point of real understanding, even of the abilities that I had. I didn't know where they were coming from. I didn't know how to increase them. And I didn't have any reference point. So that I felt like I could just spin and just go out as far, you know, out into the atmosphere, and there would be nothing that would ever define who I was and what life was about. First, I found the teachings of self-realization through Vivekananda. But then I saw Swami Kriyananda, as Sherjo referred to my first meeting with him. He's now passed away from this planet. He's gone off into the infinite. Some of you may have met him. So I'm describing someone that you can see easily on film and hear on recordings, but he won't walk into the room anymore. 6 months ago, he made that decision and he walked out. But I saw him. He walked into the room. This man walked into the room from the inside out. I don't know how else to say it than that. You know, so most of us sort of live from the outside in. We carry our bodies around, and our bodies are mostly who we are and all of the things that go with it. Swamiji is a world traveler. He was born in Europe, and he traveled all over the world, spoke 8 languages. I knew him for 15 years before I even had a passport. I had never left the U.S. So I would hear him talk a lot about this. And he said in his travels that you could usually recognize what country people were from, not necessarily because they had racial characteristics, but people you couldn't tell by anything like that. You could just tell what country they were from because of the vibration that they had and the way that they moved and the way they held their mouth. He said, before you heard their language. When I heard him say this, I had no reason to disbelieve him, but I didn't believe him. And it wasn't until I myself began to travel and would sit somewhere and realize that Germans had just walked in, or that couple was English, or these people can only be from France. And he said that that was almost always the case, except once in a while you would meet someone who absolutely defied characterization. You had no way of knowing what country they were from. And he explained that at the time because such people live from the inside out, that their identification is from deep within themselves, and whatever outside influences there are, even though they'll speak the language and like the food and wear the dress and so on like that, but nonetheless, their power is rooted from deep within their own souls. Now, the path of Kriya Yoga is precisely the doorway in to that reality. And it is, in fact, and primarily thought of, as a specific technique of meditation. And it's a specific method that involves the chakras and uses the energy of the spine that cooperates with the way that we're made. But the effect of it is more than just, oh, now I have a new initiation, now I have a method that I can practice. The effect of it is that we begin to redefine our reality and we begin to live more from our origin point. Now, going back to where I started when I was saying that these are wonderful teachings, but you have to want to practice them. Master wrote, when Master first came to America, when Yogananda first came to America in 1920, he wrote a little book which was the foundation book of all his teachings, and it was called at that time The Science of Religion. Subsequently, Swami Kriyananda rewrote that book and called it God is for Everyone, and it's out on our table. It's a very fine book. And Master wrote, he was coming from India, sent by his guru, sent by the masters who share the altar with him, and he had a particular mission. And that mission was beautiful and complicated and enormously far-reaching. At the time that he landed in America in 1920, Swami Vivekananda had spent a couple of years in America. Swami Ramatirtha had made a brief visit. But no guru of the stature of Yogananda had ever come to make his home in America, who had ever come to rescue the Americans from the enormous materialism but the lack of spirituality. But coming from India to America was only the beginning of the assignment that was given to him by the masters. Because what the masters were expressing is that the entire world is moving into a new reality. And we're all living in that. I mean, just the short years that all of us have been on the planet, we see this constant and radical shifting of energy. My husband still does not use a smartphone. I mean, that's not even what they're called anymore. They're just called phones where you can send texts and have all those things like that. He still doesn't use one. And all my friends at the table today were just lamenting about how could he be so backwards as to not have a phone like that. And it's just like in a few years, something that didn't even exist has been considered to be absolutely essential for our functioning in this world. Now, all of these external changes, we think that those changes are changing us. But what's actually happening is that our consciousness is shifting in many different directions, and that greater awareness is actually causing the discoveries, causing the changes, causing the desire. And what's happening is that the world is melding into one place, and we're seeing it technologically and industrially and in business. But the masters anticipated this from a much more important level, that there have been these two streams going forward in the world. And one of them has been the spiritual, held together by the ancient culture of India. And the other is this incredibly innovative, we can do it, practical reality of America. And both of them have been incomplete. And we live in a world in which powers greater than just mere human consciousness are guiding and watching this world. This is how Yogananda describes it in his autobiography. And he came to America to bring a practical spirituality with the thought that when that practical spirituality was deeply embedded in the Western consciousness, then that same practical spirituality would come back to the East, and that India and America would unite. Yogananda's last day was March 7th, 1952, and his last public appearance was in Los Angeles, California, at a dinner that was being held to honor the Indian ambassador to America. This is 1952, so India's independence is very new. Yogananda, who had made his life in Los Angeles, California, gets up and speaks, and he's written a poem, and that poem is called My India. And in it, he describes the glory, the spiritual glory of this country. And when he finishes that poem, the last word of the poem turns into a long sigh, and he stopped his heart and fell to the ground and left his body. He had his Mahasamadhi at that moment. I mean, most dramatic, but also most symbolic of the fact that these two worlds are now coming together. And Kriya Yoga, interestingly enough, is the thread that stitches it. Because all of us are living in these different cultures and these different bodies, but as he wrote in The Science of Religion, he said, every sentient being, and certainly every human being, is motivated by two realities. And it's fascinating if we review our own lives and see how this theme is absolutely true. Every living creature wishes to escape from pain. Every living creature wishes to experience greater happiness. Even as Swamiji often said, if you have a little worm and you poke it with something sharp and it perceives it as pain, it will withdraw and try to get away from it. If you have a tiny creature and you put food over here, the animal will scurry over to grab that little bit of food. All of us, and in our own lives, every decision that we make, whether it proves ill-advised or not, is always because at the time we thought it would diminish our suffering and increase our happiness. And what happens to us over not only the experience of one lifetime, but the experience of many, many lifetimes, is that we begin to refine our understanding of where our suffering comes from and what it is that gives us happiness. In my own life, I was profoundly motivated by a deep desire to be happy. And as I was explaining, I had that dilemma in my life of apparent competence and deep inner anxiety because of not knowing where the source of my life was, what was really causing me suffering, and more deeply, what I could do about that to ease it and to bring me a greater satisfaction in life. Now, in its essence, all spiritual life is really just about that. That's why Yogananda called it the science of religion. We have enormous traditions. We have all these outward ways of behaving. We have the religions of the world that give you dogmas, and they tell you that this is how you have to behave and that this is the system that will bring you happiness, and so on. But all of them are trying to talk about a deep inner truth, which is we can tell within ourselves, you know, whether we're happy or whether we're sad. And the science of Kriya Yoga, when you get it down to its pure essence, is understanding that our happiness or unhappiness comes from the flow of energy within us, which creates the vibration of our consciousness, which leads to how we perceive reality and how we actually experience it. And Kriya teaches us it's the divine science of where happiness comes from. But the stage that we have to come to in our spiritual life, and I'm talking to all of you tonight because obviously you've come to a point where it has occurred to you that maybe there is some deliberate action that I can take that will have an effect on the trajectory of my life, on my success, on my happiness, on my relationships, whatever it might be. The greatest challenge on the spiritual life, besides finding the right technique and the right teaching, is deep within our hearts to come to that point of understanding where we really know that now I'm ready to be different. No, now I'm ready to increase my awareness. The project of life, if you think about it in one way, it's all about increasing our awareness. It's all about expanding our understanding of cause and effect, expanding our understanding of what motivates me and why do I behave in a certain way, and above all, what can I do about it? Everybody asks me, everybody in the world asks me, how can I calm my mind? How can I meditate better? How can I be happier? How can I manage all the conflicting forces of my life? The power of Kriya Yoga is that it tells us which way is forward. You know, there, Swamiji often spoke of it in this way, that in every situation in our life, we have a choice always, that we can meet life by expanding our awareness, or we can meet life by contracting and hoping to become small enough to have it go away. I had an interesting experience with my father at the end of his life. My mother had been ill for quite some time, and it was understandably a serious strain on him. I have been deeply committed to the spiritual path for a very long time, and I've come to understand that when I'm confronted with a difficulty that can't be avoided, often a difficulty causes us, pulls down our energy because it begins to dominate our field of vision or experience. And over time, living with Swamiji, I realized that you cannot always dissolve a difficulty. Some difficulties have to be endured. My parents became old, my parents became ill. There's no way you can dissolve that difficulty. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. It's the natural course of life. So we suffer when it becomes the whole definition of our field of vision. And what I learned from Swamiji is that life is going to be what it's going to be, but if we can expand our field of vision around it, then whatever it is that we have to work with suddenly comes into another context. In other words, if we can reach deeply enough within ourselves to see this from a higher perspective, to move a step back from our attachments, our involvements, our fears, our anxieties, that even exactly the same circumstances of our life are then experienced as a completely different reality. Now, once one begins to respond to life, not by holding on to the present reality, but by deciding, what can I learn from this? How can I take the power that this is giving me, expand my heart, expand my understanding, expand my wisdom, my serenity, my acceptance of the divine? The power of Kriya is the inner exercise that draws us just a little bit back from this identification with the external world and attaches us to where the real source of power comes from. Just as I was talking about that man in his book, the real power of this world is from above. And when we're living at this level, life just seems to always take us like this. But with the power of Kriya, literally, we lift our consciousness to the spiritual eye. Then you can look down from a higher level, and then the same pieces have to be moved, but they move in a completely different reality. But you have to want to go there. I was starting to say with my father, I was urging upon him an expanded understanding of the circumstances we were dealing with. And I learned something very deeply, and I said to him, "Don't you want to expand and understand this?" And he just said to me quite simply, "No." Just like that, "No." He said, I've been through enough, and now I'm just going to stay where I am until my life is over. And at that point, I realized I had much to tell him, but he didn't want to hear it from me. And I just stepped back and supported him and comforted him and was a good friend to him. But I didn't ask him after that to become bigger than he wanted to be. Because we have to have that commitment. We have to feel somewhere deep within us. I want to tell you of a very early childhood memory of mine. Because what we're doing when we're doing Kriya is we're not creating something or even imposing something on us. We are remembering a reality that we've always known. When I was a very small child, and I think this is just an evidence of past life yoga practice, my mother scolded me for some valid reason. I think my brother and I were in the back seat of the car and we were causing some kind of chaos that finally caused my parents in the front seat of the car to turn around and tell us to cease. But my mother was a very loving mother, so her scolding would have been appropriate. But I didn't like being scolded and it hurt my feelings. And I went into a little bit of a sulk like children do, and I crawled onto the floor of the car and I was kind of curled up down there sulking. But I vividly remember the solution to the problem that occurred to me. Even I must have been three, I couldn't have been more than that. I was very aware of the fact that my reality existed on many different levels. And right then I was in the level in which my mother's stern words to me made my heart hurt. And I just didn't like that feeling of my heart being hurt. But I also knew that that hurt was just on the surface of who I am. I mean, all of this, I remember it. Of course, I didn't have sophisticated words when I was three, but the soul is always full-sized. Just because someone is a child, it doesn't mean that their consciousness is less developed. It just means that they don't have the capacity to express it or to explain it. But they're experiencing it exactly the same. And so I went into myself, and I knew that if I went deep enough into myself, I would find the point where that hurt would no longer touch me. And so I just curled up on the floor until I found that point. And as soon as I was there, then all the fluctuations of my little child's life, they were still, nothing had changed outwardly, but everything had changed inwardly. Okay? Now, just as that man was talking about to that couple about the blow that was struck to their lives and to their well-being when their daughter was lost, but they had cultivated within themselves a place of love and understanding of humanity, of trust and faith in God, and the belief that every human being was equally valid in the eyes of God, to such a point that even at such a moment, they could go to there. They could go to that point. Now, at a certain point in our lives, or our many incarnations, we begin to really understand that if I can cultivate my inner reality, I am standing at the point from which everything else emanates. When we've tried to, in the temple that I live in California, we naturally try to advertise and help people to be able to be part of what we're doing. We don't proselytize, but we advertise, because we have to let people know. And you do this kind of marketing research to try to figure out what demographic, what magazines would you put your articles in, and so on. The fascinating thing about it is the people who are interested in Kriya cross all sorts of lines. It's very difficult to figure out who they are. But over many years, there's one unifying factor. And that factor is that it has begun to seriously occur to the people who are drawn to this path that I can influence my experience of life, and the way to influence it is from the inside out. And that if I can get mastery over my own emotions, over my own energy, over my own health, over my own attitudes toward other people, if I can choose my state of consciousness instead of always having it be imposed upon me by the circumstances of my life, that is the line that I want to follow, you know, through this sometimes confusing world. Now, Master's teaching of Kriya, which we're offering you, was given to him from the Himalayan masters at this particular time and place. And, you know, the teachings are renewed again and again. This is what the Bhagavad Gita tells us, that the masters reincarnate, that each new age has a new message. I'm very much, of course, familiar with the Christian Bible. And Jesus talks about sheep and wheat and kings and slaves and all sorts of circumstances that when people study the Bible now, they try to find in there sort of esoteric symbols. The fact of the matter is, Jesus was talking the opposite of esoteric. He was talking to people who grew wheat, who had slaves, who took care of sheep, who understood the power of kings. He was relating the spiritual life to their actual, what they were doing on a daily basis. Yogananda comes, and he talks about television and radio and telephone and space travel and electricity and the power of individual atoms. And he's not being esoteric. He's trying to take the same reality, the same inner teaching, but then give it to us in a way that matches the experience that we're having now. And the experience we're having now is one of energy and one of individual opportunity and individual responsibility. What Master did with the power of Kriya is he said that your spiritual life, in fact, your well-being in every respect, is entirely in your own hands. And he explained that it's a question of the energy that flows in the spine. It's a question of the vrittis in the chakras. It's a question of where you put your consciousness among those chakras, of how you pray, what you pray to, and how you direct your will, and how you generate the right kind of will. And all of that, he said, is not a matter of religion, of priest, of dogma, of culture, of having to understand Sanskrit or Hebrew or Latin, of having to go to a certain school or anything like that. He says it's entirely a question of our own motivation, which is, do we wish to experience happiness? Do we wish to withdraw from suffering? Do we wish to allow the circumstances of our life to dominate and define our consciousness, or do we want to expand our awareness so that life itself will be seen in its proper perspective? I was talking to a friend recently. I enjoyed this. Let me just say this in the right way. When I first came to Ananda Village, the first job I had was cooking in the kitchen of the retreat that we had. And I was very energetic and very hyper about a lot of things that I did. And this couple came and worked in the kitchen there with me for a while, and they washed a lot of dishes, and they were there for a few weeks. About 6 or 7 years later, I traveled with Swami Kriyananda to New York City, and we went and stayed in the home of that very couple. We went to visit them, went for dinner, and he introduced me. The name Asha is the name that Swami Kriyananda gave me. It was not the name my mother gave me, and I had known this couple before Swami changed my name. And when Swami introduced us, I said, I knew you because we worked together in the kitchen. And they looked at me just like this, and they said, we've never met. And I said, no, actually, we work together in the kitchen. No, that was someone else. We've never met you before. I actually said it a third time before I realized that Divine Mother was playing with me. And what she was really saying to me is, because of the path you've started walking, because of the practices that you're doing, you've become someone else. Because all that we ever are is an emanation of our inner energy. We're nervous, we're anxious, we're upset about something, we're afraid, we're calm, we're capable, we're creative. You know, we read people according to the energy that they're putting out. Kriya Yoga puts you in the defining position to determine what that energy will be. And the other factor that is really important to understand about this, because everybody's always saying to me, even as I walked in, I'm a householder, I have to take care of my children, I only have so much time to meditate. But even a little practice of an inward religion, as the Bhagavad Gita says, it turns our energy in a completely new direction and saves us from a great deal. So what we pick up by the practice of Kriya is not just, as I was saying at the beginning, the technique itself, but a total feeling of being in the flow of where life is really going. And even if our formal practice is confined to whatever time we have because of all our other duties, all of our other duties also become easier to carry because we have attached ourselves to the source of energy. Now, that's a sort of a pep talk for the practice of Kriya, because it's not something that I can teach you in this evening, because a certain amount of appropriate preparation is required. But what I'm wanting you to understand is just in a general way sort of what it's about and why it's beneficial to you. I'd like to just pause for a moment and ask if you have specific questions about Kriya particularly, about any aspect here. Yes, sir.
Well, firstly, why aren't there specific books on the process of Kriya Yoga? One. And the second thing, I was in Lonavala a few months back, that Patanjali Yoga Sutra, they very simplistically outline the process of Kriya Yoga in 3-4 things one has to do. I have done that, and I felt a little better, but how is this Kriya Yoga different from the Patanjali thing, which doesn't have, at the end you have to do some Gayatri Mantra, and before that you have to have some kind of pranayama steps, and that's about it. So,
the Kriya technique is actually a physical technique. It involves the breath, it involves the spine. It's something that you can learn step by step. Sit like this, do this, breathe like this, concentrate like this. But the power of it is not just sit like this, breathe like this, concentrate like this. The power of it is also that we put ourselves in relationship to the source, the transmitting source of that. In other words, through initiation and discipleship. Okay, just a moment, sir. Okay, so part of the reason that you can't just put it in a book is because you pick up the book, you read the technique, and you think you've actually got it. When in fact, in order for it to work, you have to know what you're attuning yourself to, and you have to be in that vibration, which is more subtle than just, I can do this by myself. See, part of the illusion that traps us in the suffering that we have is that we don't see ourselves in right relationship to a greater reality. So we need to understand Kriya properly. You have to understand that greater reality. You have to understand the particular expression of spirituality, if you take Kriya through us, that's brought through these masters. And that's something that takes a little time to absorb. It's not something that just in one reading, one book, one evening, oh, I have this, because it's moving us, it's refining our vibration, it's sensitizing us to fields, force fields in the universe that we don't already know. It's attuning ourselves like a radio to receive certain vibrations of consciousness that are there. And it's just not that simple. That doesn't mean it's hard to do, but it takes time to find it. And even the practice of Kriya is actually offered in four stages. So there's the first preliminary technique. It's like it has four legs of the table. So it takes time. You learn the first, the second, the third, the fourth. Why can't I be a nuclear engineer today? Because I can't be unless I learn everything that's required so that when I get those final understandings, I know where they are. It's just not that easy to transform ourselves. And so we obviously have to dedicate ourselves to it a little bit more. Swami Yogananda was very definite. Swami Kriyananda was the same. Kriya is open to anybody who wants to do it, but they have to learn it in the right way, or else they don't actually have it. And so I think you're referring to the Yoga Sutras. It makes reference because Kriya is not invented. Yogananda did not invent Kriya. He re-expressed it in a way that was easily to grasp. But it's based on the way we're made. So every true spiritual teaching has Kriya or something like it. But where you receive that Kriya, from which master and in which context, brings with it the vibration of those great ones. And that's the power. I mean, when I was talking to a group just the other night, Kriya itself is a means for attuning ourselves to that power. And we align ourselves, and then that power comes into us, but it's the power that really transforms us. It's not our doing this little thing and that little thing, and suddenly I'm different. It's when we do those things, suddenly we align, and then the force of that grace comes into us. Initiation is a must. Discipleship is a must. Guru is everything. Fair enough. Is there another question?
I can share one very small example. Many years back, I read the autobiography of an Indian yogi. Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
And I was in Bombay as a 4 to 5 year old child. Uh-huh. And my mother asked me to garland Anandamayi Maa. Uh-huh. One of the seers mentioned in the book. So those days I could see, as I approached her, some hill, some glow. Uh-huh. But over the next few decades of my life, I have lost that capability. Uh-huh. And how can we re-get that state?
That's a very poignant question. The gentleman said when he was a child he was close to Anandamayi Maa and saw the light of the spirit around her, but now at this stage of his life he doesn't see it anymore. Actually, when I was reflecting on this talk before I came, I was thinking about what a struggle life is for all of us. We have this idea when we're children that it's going to be easy. And they did a study in America once and asked people what their happiest memory was. And many people said it was the day they graduated from high school in America when they have a big dance party and everybody, the senior prom it's called. That was their happiest time. Swamiji commented on that because that's the point in your life when all your dreams are going upward and you imagine they'll be easy to achieve. And then what comes to us is the real hard work that's required, just the necessity to educate, to make relationships, to earn money, to struggle against other people's opinions. And it's very rare. It's easy to see people who are very radiant when they're young. And it's much rarer to see people who still have that light in their eyes when they're old. I was at the grocery store, and there was a young and an older woman together. It was a daughter and her mother. And they had the same face, except the mother's face was exhausted and the daughter's face was still hopeful. And I know that she imagined she would never look like her mother. But you could also see that she had the same consciousness as her mother, and inevitably she would look as worn out as her mother. Now, that happens because we do not cultivate the inner life. We allow our external life to dominate us, and actually over time we begin to just drain out. That's exactly what happens. And it's very, I mean, my father was a perfect example, a very good man, but he had not cultivated his inner reality. And when the stress came, he didn't have an inner world to go to. Yogananda described it as a portable paradise. When I was 22, is actually when it was, when I first read that phrase, the portable paradise, I always remembered it, and I've remembered it many times since then. We carry within ourselves a portable paradise. But in our education and in our values of society, of course, the Indian culture holds more of this than America does. But even in India, you see, it's become very externalized. And so we think if we go to the temple, if we hire the priest, if we do the puja, but we're not practicing the real self-realization, which is the real power behind all of those things, which is, where is my own consciousness? And on a day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute basis, what reality am I affirming? And too often what we affirm is the drudgery of life, the externals of life, and we don't scientifically bring ourselves back to that wellspring of inner spirit. But it hasn't left you. You are no less capable, and you are no less a part of that infinite spirit now than you were when you were five. It's just living in the world as long as we have, our consciousness has wandered away from it. When we're children, we're not tired yet. And that's what Master is really teaching us with this technique. When he was in America, the way Swami described it, when he first came, he was in his 20s. He was a dynamic man in his 20s. He wore his orange robes and he had long hair. And he was in America, nobody had ever seen anything like this. And he was a phenomenon in the country, and all the biggest cities, all the biggest halls, he would speak. And this is how Swami described it, or was described to him. Master would run out onto the stage, and then he would say to the audience, "How feels everyone?" And he would lead them in saying, "Awake and ready." And then he would say, "How is everyone?" And then he would have them say again, "Awake and ready," like this. I mean, just drawing them into the power that he had. And he said only in that atmosphere would he then be willing to talk about what he had to talk about. He was shaking everybody awake. And even in Autobiography of a Yogi, when he talks about Kriya, he just, you know, tells you that so much can happen. But it can, even no matter what stage we are in life, we can turn it back and we can find that again, because it doesn't leave us. We just stop paying attention to it. And all we have to do is turn our attention back and you discover that it's right there again. Okay?
This is a really important question he put to you. It's about his being a child and experiencing that arrow.
Yeah.
At this time, we are all very close to our super consciousness. We are part of God. And then we have the capability of experiencing that. Over a period of time, there are layers and layers and layers. And we get away from that, connect to the divine. Gradually, now, as you said, you know, it's a part of that, actually. And the question of just removing those layers and keeping inside.
And Kriya peels back the layers. really just as simple as that. Kriya, discipleship, satsang, devotion, prayer, it's all a whole way of life. But this is where I was starting. You have to want to do it. And nobody can persuade you. Nobody. It just has to suddenly rise out of the surface of your own heart that says, I remember that I used to be different and I want to go back to that. Whether you remember it from childhood, you remember it from a past life, wherever it's coming from. Swami Kriyananda says himself, he was very, very joyful and very free as a child. Until about the age of 9, he had certain illnesses, and he became concerned about the fact that he was so different than everyone else. So he tried to conform to the life as he saw it around him. And by the time he was in college age, as he put it, he'd become so intellectual in his mind that all the sweetness that he remembered from his childhood was gone, and he became desperate to get back to it. And that was what started him on the spiritual search. When I was first with Swami Kriyananda, I said to him, I've always had this intense desire to be happy, but I've never been unhappy. It was kind of a paradox for me. And he said, but in previous lifetimes you've suffered. And I went through an experience not too long ago where a relative of mine passed away at a relatively young age, and I went to the funeral. There was no religious context in the funeral. There was no belief in afterlife. There was nothing. There was no context whatsoever. This person had lived, they had died, and it was over. The husband was deeply grieved. The family was wealthy and well-placed, but now the wife was gone. I mean, these things happen. Everybody was suffering so much, and there were so many things I could say, but none of them would have been received because nobody was interested. In America, it's like that. And it was hurting my heart so much to see these people suffering. But then I realized, oh yes, this is the kind of suffering that gradually drives us to seek an inner reality. Because we put all our faith and all our hope in the external world, and it's just waves on the surface of the sea. Even if we can hold it in place for a brief period of time, after a while it's just going to shift into something else. Just we'll get worn out, and that beautiful freedom of childhood will go away. But you see, that is not really the truth of our lives. The truth of our lives is that we have an eternal wellspring of unlimited bliss inside of us, but we haven't cultivated it. And so it's silted over. It's silted over with all of our other karmas, and the process of Kriya is just flushing it out again. And just like I with those people in New York, no, we've never met you before. And I said, okay, I think you're right. You know, because who we are before we start becoming who we are, we can just change again and again and again and again. Master talked about a woman he met in America. She was 80 years old before she met him and found the spiritual path. He said, but she realized God in that lifetime. She'd never even thought about it, but she became so determined. It's just a question of we've put energy in one direction, and now we just put it in the other. It's completely within our hands to do so. Any other? Yes, sir.
We talked about the 4 levels of Kriya Yoga. The paper which has been given to us talks about 2 weekends or something like that. Right. For about 3.5 hours each.
Right.
So level 1B or something. Is it level 1 only 7 hours of that entire thing? And what about the other 2nd, 3rd, and 4th?
You can speak to Sherjo and others afterwards in detail, but I was using vocabulary. I was contradicting the words. There are 4 basic techniques, of which Kriya is through initiation is the 4th. But you will learn those in the course of the 2 courses that they offer. So you'll be brought to the level where you'll be qualified for initiation. You can start. Am I accurate in that, or am I completely wrong? I'm close to accurate. Somebody can tell you. Did you have a question, sir?
Would it be easy or difficult for someone to learn the technique based on their personality type?
Based on their personality type? Well, you know, the marvelous thing about the spiritual path is whoever you are, you get better at being who you are. And Yogananda himself taught so much. He actually said, you have to do 1/100th part of what I taught. He said, and that will be sufficient to bring you great spiritual progress. So everybody, based on personality type, picks out the part that appeals to them. Some are devotional, some are serviceful, some are withdrawn, you know, all of those. So a true spiritual path magnetizes your natural tendency and brings it out. So we, even though we start with teaching you something that's predictably the same, Swami calls it the art and the science. The science is that we are all essentially made the same and we can work in a certain way. The art is to know with that paint box exactly what picture you want to paint for yourself. And so both actually have to play together in order to be successful. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts?
Is this whole practice, whatever it is, I'm not aware. But what I understand, during the Brahma Muhurta, that is anywhere between 1.5 hours to 3 hours before sunrise, that time is very, very effective for all spiritual activities. Now, would you give any such directive to our beginners, initiators?
We are part, all of us live in an interconnected universe, and we are all always being affected by the flow of all sorts of energies around us. And it is unmistakable that certain hours of the 24-hour day have different vibrations. And that's a fact, and it's quantified over time by rishis and sages. One of my friends says, for example, it's impossible to do creative work until it's dark, because in the dark, you're more attuned. So we do recommend meditating in relation to those hours. However, as we always say in the meditation class, the best time to meditate is when you will meditate. The best time to meditate is when you actually have time to do it. Because in the life that we all live now, you know, we're so pressured and we have so many responsibilities that we can't set impossible conditions. This is the practicality of the West brought to the ancient wisdom of the East. The ancient wisdom of the East may declare that these are the ideal hours. The practicality of the West says, but the only time I can meditate is now. So we try to put both of those forces together and then just make the best of what we can do. God is very forgiving. You know, sometimes we imagine that he's so stuffy and dogmatic that if we make some tiny little mistake, then that's it. Not at all. He's a loving mother. You know how a friend of mine was wearing this necklace? It was just this big clunky piece of plaster with some really ugly colors on it. Her son had made it for her, and she was going to wear it around, and she loved it, because it was offered to her with love. And so when we sit to meditate, and this is the more subtle aspect of it, this is a love relationship with the divine. And when you offer your devotion and your commitment to build this relationship, God's not going to say, oh, you should have done it 2 hours ago. He's going to say, welcome, my child. I'm so glad that you're here with me. So then we practice the art of it. If we find, oh, yes, that really is, these are the hours for me because this really works, then it becomes our own personal decision at that point. Yogananda is trying to liberate spiritual teachings from too much complexity of external rules and bring it back to what really counts, which is our own actual experience. He made the statement, the only place God can be experienced is in the human nervous system. I find that statement so bizarre. But what he really means is, this is inward. This is an inward reality. And all of these other things have meaning if they stem from the inside. Because it's the experience that counts. All of religion and ritual is an attempt to create that experience. But what Yogananda is giving us is the opportunity to go right into the experience. And then we discover that much of the rest of it is also true. But it's from the inside out, is how it grows. Any other questions or thoughts? Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much for your talk. So just would you mind talking a little more about what is Kriya Yoga? I mean, I understand that it's a holistic way of life, but would you also say that it's a predominantly meditative practice? And is it something like aligning oneself with Kundalini energy? Does it have to do anything with the temple?
Yes, yes, and yes. Kriya is a very specific way of meditating. You sit like this, you concentrate like this, you make your spine like this, you visualize like this, you breathe like this, you form a connection with the guru like this, you affirm like this, and those things are taught in a very systematic way. You build up to that by first learning to work with the breath, then you learn to work with the energy, then you learn to work with the sound of the om, then you put it all together in initiation and Kriya proper. Along the way, you learn about what discipleship is, you learn about what these masters teach, you have the opportunity to see, to feel that vibration and whether it matches. And in the end, you're working with the Kundalini, you're working with the breath, you're specifically meditating, sitting still in perfect silence, like a good yogi, morning and night in front of your altar, doing it just like that. From that, a whole understanding of life begins to grow. If, in fact, my experience of life emanates from the energy flowing in my spine, if by my own actions I can influence that flow of energy, if I am in relationship to a higher power, then everything else that I do is also going to be touched by that. And thus comes all the rest of what he teaches about prayer, about right attitude, about healing, about right relationships, about how to magnetize money, how to raise your children, how to educate your children, how to do creative work. It just, look at the books, it goes on and on. But it all starts from the fact that by my own deliberate effort, I can discover a flow, a reality within me that is the source of everything else. Okay, is that clear enough? Okay. There was a question on this side? Or did I miss it? Okay. Yes, sir.
Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, 6th chapter, Dhyana Yoga. What is the difference between Dhyana Yoga and Kriya Yoga? Is it the same?
Dhyana Yoga, as I understand, is the wisdom approach to spiritual life. I mean, understanding reality by using the power of the discrimination to discern what is eternal and what is transitory. The practice of Kriya Yoga is completely consistent with that, because when we begin to experience our inner energy, by definition, it begins to make it clear to us what is eternal and what is transitory, and it makes the practice of Jnana Yoga more grounded in experience, because we can begin to experience consciousness beyond the brain, we can begin to experience our own reality beyond the body, and that's going to start putting everything into perspective. It's not that we don't still live in this world, but we begin to see it in a greater context, just what I was saying before. So everything that's in the Gita is completely supported and expressed through the practice of Kriya Yoga. Yogananda taught from the Bhagavad Gita and from the New Testament, and everything that he brought was an expression of those teachings. Okay? Is that fair enough? Yes, sir.
I have two questions. I want to take spiritual life in your professional work for continuously. And what is the technique of blending spirituality in every aspect of your life? Every moment. Because you are advocating, suppose if I meditate for some time, I try I may reach certain spiritual level. But you want to lead life continuously on the spiritual path while performing your professional task. What is your suggestion to go in that direction? Suppose you want to lead that spiritual life continuously along with my professional life.
Okay.
So how is it possible?
One of the things that's happening at this particular time in the global evolution, so people are beginning to understand that everything is energy in different forms. So spiritual life, professional life are just different expressions of your own life energy. Now it's concentrated inwardly, now it's expressed outwardly. Now that's the beginning thought, that there really isn't such a division. It's just an expression of consciousness in different forms. However, the greatest obstacle, and if you think about this, that all of us experience to professional success, to personal happiness in our relationships, to creative work, is that we do not have mastery over our own energy. We lose concentration. We become concerned about other people's opinions. We don't have confidence. We don't have intuition, so we're not sure what the right choice is. And those are the things that cause us in our professional lives to have difficulty. If we have self-mastery, if we can focus our attention on a task, if we can align ourselves with higher inspiration and have creative ideas, if we can be compassionate and understanding of other people's realities and know how to bring the best out of the people around us, everything in our life is going to flow better. The secret of self, the reason we don't have self-mastery is because we do not understand or have control over our own energy. And meditation and the practice of Kriya especially makes us familiar with our inner energy and gradually allows us to choose how and in what way that energy is directed, which is as easily translated into creative work, loving relationships, money magnetism, great art, as it is translated into the inner experience of the spiritual eye. So that's part of the practicality of the West and the spirituality of the East, is that we begin to understand that it's just one flow. A young friend of mine who had very great worldly ambitions was afraid to get involved with the spiritual life because he was afraid it would mean he couldn't follow those ambitions. And I said to him, "What is the greatest obstacle that you meet?" He said, "Myself." Master yourself, and everything else that you aspire to will come. If we educated people like this from the beginning, we wouldn't lose it. We would just, and we are actually in our Ananda communities, we have schools. If self-realization is the goal of life, if you have inner mastery, then how does the rest of the life flow? Yes, so what, excuse me, just before I give you a second, is there anyone else who has a first question? Well, here's another second question, but go ahead.
Wouldn't you say that this is the ultimate goal, your technique itself as a means to expanding the realization that you have into the other aspects?
Absolutely.
And therefore, your professional, there would be absolutely no boundary between these.
There is no boundary. There is, everything that we do is an expression of consciousness in one form or another. There is no boundary. That's absolutely true. That's what the power of Kriya begins to show you, that I become what I want to be, and then I express it in whatever way I choose. This is part of the vital message of Kriya Yoga is to no longer divide the world up, but to live, to see that it's, I mean, where is God absent? He really actually is in the office. It's just that we don't notice. So we improve our power of knowing. Yes, you wish.
Today we see a lot of illness, sickness in the world.
Right.
See, the hospitals are full
of
people. What is the role of Kriya Yoga in combating disease?
It's very interesting because Ananda Village, which has been now 40 years in existence, it's Ananda's first community in California. There's a medical clinic associated with it, a doctor who's a Kriyaban, and he has thousands of patients, and only a small percentage of them are Kriyabans. The health and vitality of the Kriyabans is so notable. And of course, there are lifestyle differences also, but part of what Kriya, one of the four techniques that leads you to Kriya is what we call the energization exercise, where you learn to consciously draw life force into your body. So from the point of view of health and well, just from the point of view of physical health and well-being, Kriya Yoga practice is an enormous asset. If everyone in the world practiced Kriya Yoga, we would not have the healthcare crisis we're having. And many other reasons. But yes, because you see, disease is the result of either blocked energy or inadequate energy. And blocked energy is the result of imbalance in one way or another, and becoming more attuned to the inner energy smooths those imbalance. And inadequate energy, we exist in an ocean of energy, and if we understand how to use our willpower to draw that energy in, which is one of the four techniques that leads up to Kriya, is the energization exercise, number two. Okay? And you really become, you know, Swami Kriyananda, he was phenomenal. Even when he was unwell toward the end of his life, he couldn't move his body around very well. But his energy, the last month of his life, he wrote one of his finest books. I mean, he couldn't get up from a chair without Shurjo and Narayani, who were taking care of him, one on either side. He couldn't walk across a room without two people helping him. But the fact that his body was 86 and wasn't working so well anymore, as soon as he was sitting down, the infinite just flowed through him without the slightest obstacle. And at one point when he was physically relatively unwell, I looked around the room. There were like 15 people industriously carrying out projects that this man was just initiating just from sitting there because of the capacity he had developed from all those years of Kriya practice to just be a pure channel for divine energy. So whatever level, emotional, mental, spiritual, worldly ambition, it behooves us to get mastery over our own energy, and then we can direct it however we choose. I'm going to go behind you first. Yes, sir.
Where do you see a role of understanding various scriptures like be it Bhagavad Gita or Quran or Bible, and the role of Kriya Yoga?
I think that they're beautifully compatible, because when you begin to have inner experience, you begin to understand what the scriptures are talking about. And Yogananda has written, Kriyananda has published, commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, revelations of Christ, explanation of Patanjali Yoga Sutra, also the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And all of them are explained from the point of view of inner experience. And they become much deeper and much more meaningful and much more practical. The difficulty with sometimes with scripture practice is it's fascinating, it's even uplifting, but you don't exactly know how to apply it. Kriya helps you to understand what they were talking about, and oddly enough, how you can take it to the office. Yeah.
Do you think either of it would independently help, or always in a combination with it?
In combination with it, I would say, but you don't have to know anything about scripture to be able to do Kriya, because it's an experience.
Yeah, because only on the basis of meditation or Kriya Yoga, you think that a person will be able to overcome all the delusions of life or all the...
The answer in principle, is yes. Once you become interested in spiritual life, you become interested in many other aspects of it, generally speaking. But one does not require the other. Kriya Yoga stands alone. Because if you do Kriya sufficiently, you'll have the same revelation as those who wrote the scripture. So it won't be necessary to read their writings. But for most of us, it's inspiring to be in touch, and it's instructive to be in touch. So they go together just like that. We're coming to the end of our allotted time here, and I don't want to keep you beyond that. Thank you very much. Before you step away, Sherja wants to give you a few details about how you can follow through on some of this if you feel inspired to do so. Thank you very much.